Thank you very much, Jonathan. That was excellent. I love the lyrics to that song, and I'm also, you know, I get nervous leading songs. It scares me so much more than having to speak. And the courage that it takes to get up and put your voice out there and your heart out there on the line and sing and give special music, I really appreciate that. So thank you very much. Well, I will try to keep my voice clear. For the last 2 weeks, we've had a lot of sickness running around in our house. Started with my daughter, Sarah. She got really sick during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then slowly spread to the youngest one, and then to my wife, Joy, and then it nailed me. And just as I thought I was starting to feel a little bit better, I got pink eye. Yeah. So don't worry, we've sanitized everything. I've got my lotion, got my own water bottle. If I have to clear my throat a few times, it'll have to forgive me. But I know that while I was sick, I was preparing for my sermon. And it's listened to Mr. Myers' sermon from last week about being discouraged. And I realized, wow, I really needed that. I was discouraged. I just could not seem to kick being sick. Excuse me. Missing work, missing school, feeling like I was letting people down. Really started to bother me. Then I heard Mr. Myers speak and made me think about that the discouragement really is just my attitude. It's not that being sick is all that bad. There are other people who would gladly trade places with me in a heartbeat. People who are going through trials that are life-altering, life-changing, or possibly risking their lives. So it made me think about how we endure our trials, how we get through them. I'd like us to turn over to James. James chapter 1, verse 2. It says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials." Now, I was not excited when I got pink eye. I don't know of too many people who get a trial in their life. Maybe it's something that could be kind of minor. You know, you get a flat tire on your way to work. Ugh, I'm going to be late. Nobody's happy about that. Nobody's happy about the trials that really come along afterwards, the big ones. So, how are we supposed to deal with these things? Maybe it's not that the trial is such a good thing, but it's the fact that we have an opportunity to grow. There was a movie that came out about 20 years ago, which dates me quite a bit because I was out of high school and I really liked it. Some of you might remember Billy Crystal did a movie called City Slickers. Yeah, it was a good one. You could actually let your family watch it with you. And Billy Crystal had a unique sense of humor. Had Jack Palance, which was an old-time good guy, bad guy, cowboy. So it was right up my alley. I really liked that. But there was a scene that stuck with me. These three guys were all kind of going through midlife crises. And they decided they were going to take a trip, do something that they'd never done, something they'd always wanted to do. They were going to go out and go to a dude ranch, be cowboys for a couple of weeks, you know, ride the range, you know, experience the West. So they took off. And, you know, as the saying goes, hilarity ensued. But about midway through the movie, they'd finally settled down a little bit. They figured out how to sit a horse, how to gather the cattle, and get them moving, get them started on this drive. And things had kind of calmed down enough to where they could actually ride together and just kind of start talking. There weren't any distractions, no cell phones or messages that would interrupt them, and they started talking. And one of them said, "You know, guys, this has got to be one of the best days of my life." There. Wow, that's a pretty big statement. Well, speaking of best days, let's talk about that a little bit. What was your best day? Well, Billy Crystal starts off, and he's like, "Okay, I've got one. My best day," he said, I was 7 years old. My dad takes me to my first game, my first baseball game at Yankee Stadium. He describes what it was like walking in there and his dad holding his hand and going to the seats and seeing the colors, and the field, excuse me, looking at everything that was so huge that he'd only ever seen on a small black and white television set. And he talked about sitting next to his dad and his dad taking the time to describe everything to him, how to keep score. He spent the whole day there with his dad, and he loved the game. And that was his best day. And they're all like, "Yeah, that's pretty good. So what was your worst day?" He thinks about it for a second, and he says, "Well, that was the day my wife found a lump." Now, we all know what that means. Excuse me. It means cancer. And he said, or his friends are kind of shocked, and they're like, "What? You never told us about this. We never knew." He said, "Well, it ended up being nothing." He said, "But that whole day, we waited. We waited for the news of what this was going to be. I was terrified. It was the worst day of my life." His friend said, "But if it ended up being nothing, it's a good day." He's like, "No, it was pretty awful." Excuse me. And he realized that it's kind of a matter of perspective. That, excuse me. That he was looking at it like the glass was half empty, not half full. So they move on to the second guy. They say, "Okay, what was your best day?" He says, "Well, actually it was the day I got married." His buddies are like, "What?" Because he's always complaining about his marriage and how lousy his life is. And they're like, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "You know, everything was wonderful. It was perfect. My wife, you know, she was beautiful. I was dressed up." He said, "Out of my family, I was the first one to get a real job and to get married." He said, "And I looked over, and on the front row, there's my dad. And he gives me a wink." He's like, "You know, Dad wasn't a very effusive guy, but that wink meant something. I was a man." He said, "That day, I was a man. That was my best day." He said, "Well, what was your worst?" He said, "Well, pretty much every day after that." You know, it's a tie. So now it's the third guy's turn. And they say, "Okay, what was your worst day?" He's like, I really don't want to play." They're like, "Come on, we did it. Your turn." "No, no." So finally they badger him a little bit. And he's like, "Okay, I'll tell you." He says, "I was 14 years old. My mom and my dad, they're fighting again. So because my mom caught him. Actually, she didn't so much catch him. The girl that he was having the affair with picked him up at the house." He's like, "So they're fighting, and I'm listening to it. And I realized that my dad wasn't just cheating on my mom. He was cheating on us. He was cheating on my sister and I. So I went up to him and I said, 'You're not good for us. We don't love you. I'll take care of my mom. I'll take care of my sister.' He said, my dad drew back his hand to hit me, but I didn't budge. Slowly lowered his hand. He turned around and he walked out. But from that day, I took care of my sister and my mom. That's the day I became a man. That was my best day. Those friends are stunned. Don't really know what to say. Finally, one of them says, I'm like, ah, what was your worst day? Same day. Is that a matter of perspective? Now, there's something that those writers who wrote that story knew. It is only in those times of trial that we have the opportunity to grow. People don't have to be in God's church and have the Holy Spirit to have this opportunity. It's within all of us. But there's something that we as Christians are supposed to do. We're not just supposed to find it within ourselves. We've been given God's Holy Spirit. So what is it that's going to lift us up, that's going to make our worst day our best day? Now, of course, there's always things in the Bible and stories in the Bible that we can look to whenever we have questions. We can find the answers right there. I particularly love the Old Testament. I'm a story guy. At the university, I studied English Lit. So that's where I like to go. And I'd like to pick a character from Judges. That's Samson. Now, Samson was one of my favorites as a boy. Mostly because, like all little boys, he's Hercules. You know, he's got muscle on top of muscle. He's a bad man. He's tough. He's a wild man. He's kind of like, instead of Captain America, he's like Captain Israel, right? So let's turn over to Judges. As I was preparing my sermon, I was looking at a lot of commentaries. And Samson isn't respected by very many of them. He's read pretty harshly. And if you just read what's written, it's easy to do. Because everything that's in there is true. He did it all. Every bad thing that's listed. But I also know that if someone were to write a story of my life and condense it into as brief a space as possible, and make it something that would be enlightening for someone else, they're probably going to focus on my faults, the mistakes that I've made, and the lessons I had to learn. So I want to look at Samson from kind of a human perspective. That while he was full of faults, he was also God's servant. And so many times what isn't said is maybe where the majority of the story is. So in the book of Judges and in the time of the Judges, as would happen, the children of Israel would do what was right in their own eyes. You know, they'd stop paying attention to God. They'd fall off the wagon, start chasing other gods, doing their own things. And God would have to have them be afflicted. They'd be in trouble. And usually use the Philistines to do that. And then they would cry out, and God would send them a judge, someone he would raise up to deliver them and get them back on track. Well, in chapter 13 of Judges, we're told that the Israelites had been afflicted by the Philistines for 40 years. For 40 years, the Philistines had been causing them nothing but trouble and heartache. And then we have something that happened several times in the Bible. First time, I believe, is with Abraham and Sarah. God comes to a couple that can't have a child and says, "You're going to." He already knows that child before he's even conceived. "You're going to have a child, and I'm going to use him. And this is what he's going to do." We'll start in verse 5. He's talking to Samson's mother. It says, "For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb. And he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines." And so the woman came and told her husband, saying, "A man of God came to me, and his countenance was like the countenance of the angel of God. Very awesome. It was great. But I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not tell me his name. And he said to me, 'Behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. Now drink no wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean. For the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death.'" It's prophecy. From the day he's born to the day he dies. He's God's. Now Manoah prayed to the Lord and said, "O my Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come to us again and teach us what we shall do for the child who will be born." Excuse me. So he believes. He doesn't fall on his face like Abraham and laugh. He believes. And God listened to the voice of Manoah. Excuse me. And the angel of God came to the woman again as she was sitting in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. And the woman ran in haste and told her husband and said to him, "Look, the man who came to me the other day has just now appeared again." So Manoah rose and followed his wife. And when he came to the man, he spoke to him, "Are you the man who spoke to this woman?" And he said, "I am." And again, when we hear that, "I am," you know, this is Christ, or he who would become Christ, the I am. And Manoah said, "Let your words come to pass. What will be the boy's rule of life and his work?" So the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, "Of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful." Notice he doesn't tell him what Samson's going to do. He just says, "The rules I gave to your wife, make sure you follow them. She may not eat anything that comes from the vine, nor may she drink wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean. All that I have commanded her, let her observe." Now at this time, Manoah wants to feed this man, which is what they always did. You fed. It was hospitality. But he refuses it. And he says, "But you may offer a burnt offering, but you must offer it to the Lord." Down in verse 16. For Manoah did not know that he was the angel of the Lord. And he asks him what his name is, that he may honor him. And the angel said to the Lord, or the angel of the Lord said to him, "Why do you ask my name? For it is wonderful." He's giving them these clues again. They're not quite getting it. So he's going to show them something even better. So Manoah took a young goat with the grain offering and offered it upon the rock to the Lord. And he did a wonderful thing with Manoah and his wife while they looked upon. And it happened as the flame went up toward heaven from the altar that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the heart. And when Noah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground. This has been a spectacular sight. That the man standing in front of you, who's just prophesied about your coming child, ascends to heaven in the flames that you're offering up. And the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and his wife. And Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. He said to his wife, "We're going to die. You know, you're not allowed to see God and live because we have seen him." But his wife said to him, "If he had wanted to kill us, he would have done it already. He would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands, nor would he have shown us all these things. He would have told us such things as these at this time." And so she bore a son and called his name Samson. And the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. So from his birth, Samson's got God working with him directly. And we know that in the Old Testament, very few people were given God's Holy Spirit. Samson's getting worked with from birth. We're told that if we repent and believe in Christ and follow him and are baptized, that we'll receive God's Holy Spirit. He doesn't do any of that. He gets it from birth. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him at Mahana, Dan, between Zorah and Eshtaol. Now Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. This is where things get interesting for Samson. And some of the commentators say that this was a time when he should have been rallying Israel to him. He should have seen that God's chosen me. I'm the man of the hour. They're all going to follow me. Look at me, how strong I am. Well, we also know that he's a young man. Now, as was typical in Israel, men were not allowed to speak in services until they were about 30. And it doesn't say anything about him being able to do this. So we're going to assume that Samson's somewhere between 20 and 30. Maybe his early 20s, mid-20s. And like all young men, well, think of girls. So he sees this girl. And, wow, he has got to have her. Not someone else, it's got to be her. So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore, get her for me as a wife. And his father and mother, you know, you have to understand, they've been persecuted by the Philistines for 40 years. Does it have to be a Philistine girl? Out of all of Israel, can't you find anyone that will work for you? He says, no, it's got to be her. And Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she pleases me well. But his father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord. So there was a reason that he saw that Philistine girl. That the Lord was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines. For at that time, the Philistines had dominion over Israel. Now, a lot of people, and it's pretty easy to do, will judge him by saying, well, he just likes those Philistine girls. You know, this is his big fault. And they forget about the fact that it was from the Lord. So Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came to the vineyards of Timnah. And now to his surprise, a young lion came roaring against him. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. And he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat. And though he had nothing in his hand, he did not tell his father and mother what he had done. And they didn't pick up on it either. You know, you'd think if you just had a scrap with a mountain lion, you would look like it. He's not scratched up at all. There's no blood on him. He doesn't look bad. It was easy for him. And then he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. And after some time, when he returned to get her, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. Now, a lot of people will say that he shouldn't have even been in the vineyard. Vineyards have grapes, right? He's a Nazarite. So what was he doing there? Again, this attitude. Well, maybe you don't drink, but are you going to walk around the block because there's a bar on the block? Or are you just going to walk past? Doesn't really mean anything, does it? So he comes upon the lion, the carcass, and he sees honey. And he takes some of it in his hands, and he went along eating. When he came to his father and mother, he gave some to them, and they also ate. But he did not tell them that he had taken it from the carcass of a lion. This is one thing that we can look at and say that Nazarites weren't supposed to touch anything unclean or dead. Well, he does. Now, having been chosen and a Nazarite from God, from the womb, Does he kind of take it for granted a little bit? All of us that are baptized in this room have been called by God. It's a special calling. Do we ever take it for granted? Does it ever not mean as much as it should? Well, maybe that's what Samson's going through. So they gave a feast, as the young men used to do. And it happened when they saw him that they brought 30 companions to be with him. And then Samson said to them, you know, let me pose a riddle to you. And if you can solve and explain it to me within the 7 days of the feast, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing. Now, we have to realize the incredible expense that this would have been. This wasn't just, you know, blue jeans and t-shirts. This would have been the expense of custom-made clothes, like suits, custom-made dresses. This is a lot of money. But if you cannot explain it to me, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing. And they said to him, pose your riddle, that we may hear it. So he gives it to them. And out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet. Now for 3 days they did not explain the riddle. But it came to pass on the seventh day. Now remember, this is Samson's wedding feast. It's supposed to be like one of the guys in City Slickers, the best day of his life. Doesn't really turn out that way for him, though. And it came to pass on the seventh day that they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband that he may explain the riddle to us, or else we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us in order to take what is ours? Is that not so? Now again, some of the commentaries are pretty harsh with this girl. But she doesn't think this is an idle threat. She takes it seriously. We have to remember that the Philistines at this time are the harshest nation in the world. These are the people that God has used to afflict Israel whenever they turn against him. There are also some of those that when they were given Canaan in the very beginning, he said to wipe out. Leave not a one of them alive. He's filled up with their sins. Of course, they didn't get it done, did they? So here they are. They give a threat. And she thinks they mean it. Then Samson's wife wept on him and said, you only hate me. You do not love me. You have posed a riddle to the sons of my people. You have not explained it to me. And he said to her, I haven't even explained it to my own mother. So why should I explain it to you? He doesn't understand. But she kept on, and she wept on him for 7 days while the feast lasted. And it happened on the seventh day that he told her, because she expressed him so much. And explained the riddle to this, or and she explained the riddle to the sons of her people. And so the men come, they give the answer to him, and he knows. He knows that they didn't get this on their own. There's only one way that they could have gotten it. That his new bride told them. So on his wedding feast, he feels betrayed. How would any of us feel on a day like that if we were betrayed by the person we were committing our lives to share? It says in verse 19 that the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 of their men and took their apparel and gave the changes of clothing to those who had explained the riddle. And so his anger was aroused, and he went back up to his father's house. So he goes home. He's hurt. He's mad. And he goes home. He needs to cool off. There's something that he doesn't know, though. After he's gone, Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man. Chapter 15. After a while, the time of the wheat harvest, it happens that Samson's visited his wife with a young goat. He's had time to cool off, not feel maybe quite so hurt. He's going to go back and he's going to collect his bride. Because they're already married. They had the ceremony. They had the feast. He's going to go back and get his wife. Let bygones be bygones. He even takes a gift. And he said, "Let me go into my wife, into her room." But her father would not permit him to go in. Her father said, "I really thought you thoroughly hated her. Therefore, I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister better than she? Please take her instead." And Samson said to them, This time, I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines when I harm them." Also, something that's not really stated is maybe her sister was prettier. Maybe her sister was younger, more attractive. Samson could have had her if he was really that shallow, really that selfish. What's one Philistine girl versus another? No, this was the one that God gave to him and the one that he wanted. Then Samson went and took 300 foxes. I love this story, essentially that, because he basically had to run these foxes down. How do you catch 300 foxes in traps and keep them alive? He ran them down. He caught them, dug them out of their holes. That feat in itself is incredible. He ties their tails together and puts a torch between them, and he sets them loose. And they go into the standing grain of the Philistines and burned up both the shocks and the standing grain, as well as the vineyards and the olive groves. He's just set them back years. How long does it take for, you know, someone to develop grape vines and, you know, that they can make wine out of? Years and years. And the Philistines are noticeably upset. "Who has done this?" And they answered, "Samson, the son-in-law of the Temanite, because he had taken his wife and given her to his companion." So the Philistines came up, and they did what they said they were going to do. They burned Samson's wife and her father-in-law to death. Remember how I said that people could read her pretty harshly? They did what they said they were going to do, and she knew it. Maybe she really was terrified. Maybe those tears that she shed, begging Samson to tell her the story or the riddle, was sincere. And now Samson says, "Since you would do this thing, I will surely take revenge on you. And after that, I'll cease. Let it be done. It'll be over." And so he attacked them hip and thigh, and with a great slaughter, they went down, and then he dwelt in the cleft of the rock of Edom. In his mind, it's over. He's going to go off into the wilderness and find a cave and hide. He's going to lick his wounds. How badly must he be hurting? How deep did those scars go? Now the Philistines went up and encamped in Judah and deployed themselves against Lehi. And the men of Judah said, "Why have you come against us?" And they say, "We're here to arrest Samson, to do to him as he has done to us." Then 3,000 men of Judah went to the cleft in the rock of Edom to get Samson. And he said, "Do you know that the Philistines rule over us? What is this you have done to us?" And he said to them, "As they did to me, so I have done to them." Now you have to realize that there's 1,000 Philistines who came and encamped against them. There's 3,000 men of Judah. Three times the number of the Philistines. I'd give odds for them. I think they could have taken them. But they don't. They say, okay, don't do anything. We'll go get Samson for you. We'll deliver him to you. So they take 3,000 guys to go get one guy. Now this kind of shows you what the respect and some of the fear and awe they must have had of Samson. You know, I think of when you see a cop pull somebody over and they radio in and they get some sort of description. Maybe there's a warrant out for them. And they call for backup. Here's one guy with 3,000 men coming to get him. And they're nervous. You know, they're like, do you want to go in there and get him? I don't. So they get together and they go down. And they say, we've come to arrest you, that we may deliver you to the hand of the Philistines. I just imagine what Samson must have felt like when they told him that. His own brethren coming to get him and deliver him to his enemies. And Samson said to them, okay, just swear to me that you won't kill me yourselves. Sounds like hurt to me. His own brethren, his own people, his own family are going to turn him over so that their enemies can kill him. So they spoke to him, saying, no, but we will tie you securely and deliver you into their hand, but we will surely not kill you. And they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. And when they came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. And the ropes that were on his arms became like flax, and it burned with fire. And his bonds broke loose from his hands. And he found the jawbone of a donkey, reached out his hand and took it, and killed 1,000 men with it. He killed all of them. Every one of them. Doesn't say that he got any help either. And then Samson said, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, and with the jawbone of a donkey, I have slain 1,000 men. I think this is probably Samson's big mistake. His big flaw. Because did he really do it? Or was it God? Could he have done that without the Spirit of the Lord coming mightily upon him? No. Can any of us overcome the trials and obstacles in our lives without God? We're told that we can do nothing without him. And so it was that when he had finished speaking, he threw the jawbone from his hand and called the place Ramoth-Leha. Then he became very thirsty. And so he cried out to the Lord and said, have you given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant, and now I'm going to die of thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised? So God does something that he's done before, the children of Israel in the wilderness. And he split the hollow place that is in Lehi, and water came out and he drank. And the Spirit returned and he revived. And therefore he named the place En-Hakor, which is in Lehi to this day. And he judged Israel from that day 20 years. Now again, we look at Samson, and we figure, look at this guy. He's so full of himself. But it says that he judged for 20 years. It doesn't say that he was a bad judge. I know in my own life and knowing people, usually if somebody does something bad, we hear about it. We don't always hear about if they do something good. It's just who they are. It's part of their job. They're supposed to be good. But we hear about the bad stuff. Bad news travels fast. But here we have 20 years with the absence of anything bad being reported. So maybe we should cut them a little slack. Maybe, like we would want for ourselves, just be given the benefit of the doubt. Now then, Samson is found with another Philistine girl, a prostitute, which is something that kind of surprises a lot of people. Didn't he learn anything? Well, he's had 20 years since the day of his wedding, since all of this happened. And it never says that he marries. It never says that there's another girl. I wonder why. I think he was too hurt, maybe. I mean, he must have been the most eligible bachelor in all of Israel. But there's no word that he ever seeks anyone else. In fact, He goes across the border, and he's only mentioned two times, but he seeks something else. It's not a good thing. It's wrong. It's a sin. And he knows it. But he does it anyway. Now, while he's there, he's laying with this girl. The men of the city realize that he's there, their arch enemy. They band together, and they're going to get him. And they wait in the city so that they know he has to come out in the morning. And Samson lay low till midnight. And he rose at midnight and took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two gateposts. And he pulled them up, bar and all, and put them on his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. Again, as a kid, this is pretty amazing. By some estimates, these gates were huge, upwards of 2 tons. And he not only picked them up, but he ripped them out of the ground and away from the wall. He put them on his shoulders and he carried them to the top of a mountain. It must have put the fear into these Philistines. See somebody do that. And I would have a hard time carrying myself to the top of a mountain right now. And he did it carrying a burden that would have crushed me. So he gets away from them. Now afterward, we'll skip down to verse 4. It happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. Another Philistine. And here's something that's also interesting, is the word love. It's the first time that that word has cropped up in Samson's story. He loves her. She's not just a girl. She's not just one that he sees afar off and says, I want her. It says he loves her. And the men, the lords of the Philistines, come to her, and they offer her money so that she will find out the source of Samson's strength, so that they might overpower him, and they may bind him. And they offer her 1,100 pieces of silver. Now, this isn't just a little bit of money. This is a king's ransom. This is a fortune. And we're not told that Delilah loves him. So she agrees. Now, as the story goes, she starts cajoling him, and come on, tell me the secret of your strength. If you love me, you'll tell me. And 3 times, he tells her something that's not true. He tells her that if you bind me with fresh bowstrings that have not yet dried, yeah, I'll be just like any other man. She does. Now, the thing is that she doesn't really believe him because she tests it. And Samson gets up and he breaks his bonds. He does this 3 times. Now, after the 3rd time, she's really irritated. Not only is she putting up with him, but she's probably also taking a lot of pressure from the Philistine lords. And she's not getting paid. She's not getting her money. And Samson gives in. Why? Well, we're only told that he loves her. Now, how many of us do something for someone that we really don't want to do, but we do it because we love them? You know, I've said oftentimes I'll go shopping or do something around the house that I really don't want to do, but I do it because I love my wife. It would make her happy. And just like the way our wives do things for us, you know, my wife really doesn't want to go to the gun show. But sometimes she will, and she'll patiently walk around and ask me questions so I feel good about it. And she does it because she loves me. And she wants me to be happy. Well, Samson loves Delilah, and she's pushing it, and so he tells her. And it came to pass that when she had pestered him daily with her words and pressed him, so that his soul was vexed to death, that he told her all his heart, and he said to her, "No razor has ever come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb." If I am shaven, then my strength will leave me, and I will become weak and be like any other man. This time she knows. He told her his heart. And she knows. She doesn't even have to test it. And when she'd seen that he had told her all his heart, she sent and called the lords of the Philistines, saying, "Come up once more, for he has told me his heart." So the lords of the Philistines came up, and they brought their money. And she lulls him to sleep, and she calls for a man, and they shave his head. And it says, then she began to torment him, and his strength left him. So he wakes up to the woman that he loves, tormenting him. We're not told how. This is a bad way to wake up. It's like waking up into a bad dream. But then it only gets worse, because he's set upon by the Philistines. And he thinks that he will rise up as he has before, and he will shake them off of him. But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. See, it wasn't his hair. It was never his hair. The hair was just a sign of his covenant with God. It was given before he was born. It was always, and had always been, God. And the Philistines took him, and they put out his eyes, and they brought him to Gaza. Now, I can't imagine that they were very gentle about it. Samson's story is just getting worse. I don't know if any of you as kids maybe have ever blindfolded yourselves or blindfolded somebody and say, okay, now I'm going to lead you around the yard. And this is probably your best friend, and you're playing with each other. And it's scary. You know, you could walk into anything. You're feeling around. Well, he's blind. Same way. Can't see anything. He's in agony. And the people who are leading him are not people he can trust. How terrifying must that trip have been? And they brought him down to Gaza, and they bound him with bronze fetters, and he became a grinder in the prison. Now, grinding back then was done with a huge wheel, a stone, and a big bar that came out of it, and they would typically harness a very powerful animal to it, a donkey or an oxen. And what they do is they harness Samson to it, and they make him grind the mill. Now, he's in prison at night. I can't imagine that they're feeding him very well. And he's having to work all day. I doubt that it was an 8-hour day. Probably wasn't even a 10 or 12-hour day. And then at night, he's left alone in a cell. And I can't imagine that the Philistines' prison or dungeon was very good. You know, in the United States, nobody wants to go to prison. And we've got the best prison system in the world, the nicest, most comfortable. You know, if you read about prisons in other nations, third world countries, if you go to prison, you're going to die. You're not going to be taken care of. It's awful. So here he is, blind, being basically worked to death. He's probably incredibly emaciated, hungry, dehydrated, and he's all alone. Now we aren't told how long Samson's kept in that cell and in those conditions, but we do know it wasn't a few days or a week. It was long enough for his hair to start to grow again. And what must those nights have been like? All those days pushing that wheel. You think he talked to God? You think he realized all of the mistakes he'd made in his life? You know, I think of Mark Antony's speech from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, where he says that Caesar was ambitious, and if it were so, it were a grievous fault, and grievously hath Caesar answered it. If Samson made mistakes, he's paying for it. So time goes by, his hair is growing out, and the lords of the Philistines gather together to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. And they said, "Our God has delivered into our hands Samson, our enemy. and the people saw him, they praised their God. And they said, he's delivered into our hands our enemy, the destroyer of our land, the one who mutilated our dead. And so it happens after a while, they've been partying. And I can imagine that as the most depraved nation in the world at that time, pretty much everything pagan would have been going on. Everything that we read about, that we're told that the Canaanites did, would have been happening. And they call for Samson, that he may perform for us. So they called for Samson from the prison, and he performed for them. And then they stationed him between two pillars. Something else that I think is interesting is, while all of this is going on, it says that they're going to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon. But there's no mention of oxen or sheep. This is a pagan people who would let their children burn in fire. I wonder what their sacrifice was going to be. I wonder if they told Samson what their sacrifice was going to be. So while he's out there performing, they're probably jeering and laughing, spitting on him, throwing things. And he's about as weak as he can be. He's been in a dungeon for maybe a year, maybe more. And he's enduring all of this. Does it get any worse? Does it get any lower? And Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand, "Let me feel the pillars which support the temple, so that I can lean on them." And now the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there, about 3,000 men and women on the roof watching while Samson performed. And now, Samson does the right thing. He's probably been talking to God for a long time, but now he asks for the right thing. O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray, just this once. O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines from my two eyes. You know, there was another commentator that said Samson hadn't learned a thing. Here he is, he just wants vengeance for his eyes. But again, let's remember that it doesn't say that the children of Israel or the men of Judah tried to rescue him. It doesn't say that anybody came for him. Not an army, not ambassadors. He was just left to rot. And Samson took hold of the two middle pillars which supported the temple, and he braced himself against them, one on his right and the other on his left. And then Samson says, "Let me die with the Philistines." Now he had to have known at that moment that God's Spirit had returned to him. It fell mightily upon him. Isn't it possible that Samson could have asked for something else? That he gets his vengeance, but that maybe he's saved? God could have given him back his eyesight, had he asked. He could have asked that every stone in that temple fall all around him, leaving him untouched, to return as a judge of Israel, as a hero. But he doesn't. He just wants it to be over. And God honors his request. Because God, unlike all of us, can see Samson's heart. All the trials that he's been through, everything he's endured, all of his faults and mistakes, God sees his heart and honors his last request. And he pushed with all of his might, and the temple fell on the Lord and all the people who were in it. So the dead that he killed at his death were more than he killed in his life. Samson's worst day was Samson's best day. He turned back to God, and he finished his work. He got the job done, and he did it well. Now it says his brothers and all his father's household came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the tomb of his father Manoah. And he judged Israel for 20 years. You know, they say that they know where Samson's buried today, that you can still go and see his tomb. And I can't verify it. I've just seen pictures and people talking about it on the internet. But on his tomb is written, Samson, the Messiah of his generation. In many ways, there's correlations. Because he was prophesied to come. He was given to a woman who couldn't have any children. And he delivered his people. You know, Samson's name isn't just mentioned there. It's mentioned in the New Testament. He's mentioned with the heroes of faith. So let's go ahead and turn over to Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 32. And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets. Look who he's listed with. I know some of the commentators say that, you know, well, he pulled it together at the end. But I don't really, for myself, believe in deathbed conversions. In the sermonette, we heard about faith without works. I think there was more to Samson, more to the story that we don't really know, but we can only speculate on. And these who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, and stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, and out of weakness were made strong. They became valiant in battle and turned to fight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trials of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves in the earth. And all these obtained a good testimony through faith. But they did not receive a promise. That's Samson. There's more to him than just maybe what we read. You know, we just came through the days of unleavened bread. We've looked at Christ's sacrifice for us. God who came to earth and lived a perfect life as one of us. He was tempted, endured everything just like we do, but he never sinned. He was completely innocent. And then he was taken. He was given a mock trial. He was tortured and hung on the cross. It was Christ's worst day. Everything that I just read happened to him that day. But it was our best day. Because of his worst day, we have salvation. We're given a chance. If we look over at Hebrews 12, verse 1, it says, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So this is our example, our perfect example. Now, a lot of people are going through trials. We hear about them. We hear prayer requests. It's a bad time. It's a hard time for them. And all of us will have that worst day. At some point, we're going to hear that we're going to lose our health. Or maybe our life. Maybe a spouse. Maybe a child. Maybe our job. Maybe just our home. But it's going to be, for us, our worst day. How are we going to handle it? Now, if none of those things happen to us, but if we live long enough, we know that there will be a time of persecution and trials. That worst day is going to come. So what are we going to do? Do we try to find the strength just within ourselves, our own might, our own power to endure? Or will we take the chance? Will we see it as an opportunity to find our strength, not in ourselves, but in Christ, in our faith in Him, and turn our worst days into our best?